Professor Kenny is professor of history here at Boston College, where he specializes in the history of migration. He teaches courses on American immigration history and on global migration and diaspora. He's the author of Peaceable Kingdom Lost, The Paxton Boys and the Destruction of William Penn's Holy Experiment, as well as The American Irish, A History, and Making Sense of the Molly Maguires. He's currently working on a book project that he'll be speaking about today called Diaspora, A Very Short Introduction, which is forthcoming from Oxford Press in early or mid 2013. So it's a great pleasure to have you here, and we'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Eric, and thank you, Alan, for the invitation. So this is designed as a conversation, not a lecture, obviously. I will talk for about 15 minutes, hopefully not much longer than that. You can cut me off. About the concept of diaspora. Now, first thing I should say is that I'm pronouncing it diaspora, and I think if I were living in Europe, I'd be pronouncing it diaspora, naturally, but what I'm hearing is a lot of diasporas here in North America, so go figure. I'm not going to try and change my pronunciation. I prefer diaspora, but diaspora has become ingrained. no part of my argument.
But with a capital D or a small D?
I use a small D. no part of my argument rests on that distinction, thankfully. The point is that it's a ubiquitous word. You find it all over the place. It's used in the humanities and social sciences. It's used in public and political discourse. You'll probably find it in the newspaper today or tomorrow. It's a term that has a nice ring to it in either form, especially diaspora. It rolls easily off the tongue. It may appear to add substance to what could be rather empty claims. So it's a seductive word.
I'm getting nervous.
Imagine how I feel. So we use the word an awful lot. We don't always attach a meaning to it. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. Now, how I got into this at all was through a chance encounter. I had chaired a committee where we hired a colleague in history, Heather Richardson, and shortly after we hired her, I agreed to meet Heather at a conference. And we agreed to meet at a cocktail party that was hosted by Oxford University Press, with whom I published some work in the past. So I couldn't find Heather, and I got talking to an editor, not my own editor, about this series that I like very much, which is the series of very short introductions. And some of you may know that series. They're very useful little books that fit in your back pocket and give you a quick introduction to any number of topics. In fact, there are almost 300 of them in print now. So I was telling her about that series, how much I liked it, how I read occasionally out of my field. And she said, well, that's very interesting because I'm the editor. would you like to write one? And I said, well, American history? She said, no, that's done. American immigration history, that was done. And actually, I was quite relieved because they'd be awfully hard things to write about. And then, it is my field. that it would be awfully hard to do that in that format. So she said, well, if you ever have an idea, let me know. And I thought about it, and this idea of diaspora is something I had worked on a lot. So I pitched that to her, and the injunction from the editor, she liked the idea, go ahead, do it, 35,000 words or die. That's the injunction. So that's about one-third the length of a standard monograph. So what I'm doing in that book is taking a look at the meanings, the multiple meanings of the word in current usage, looking at its origins, looking at its expansion over time, then putting together an argument of my own work where I argue essentially that diaspora isn't a thing, a social entity that I want to go out and measure so much as a perspective, an idea, a concept that can be useful in explaining the world of migration. So that's the approach I'm taking in the book. In these few minutes, I'll outline a little bit of what I mean by that. So, going back to the origins of the term, the etymological origins, this is pretty well known, and I'm not a linguist, but dia sperum in Greek, the Greek origins, would refer to a process of sowing or scattering, to spread over, to sow, to scatter. There's a root word older than Greek, spor, which we're familiar with in spread, disperse, spore, words of that kind. The Armenian diaspora is spurk. In the original Greek usage, as far as I can tell from secondary sources, and I'm making no claim to beyond that, the usage is negative, somewhat pejorative, but without a religious content, and I think that's significant. It refers in Heraclitus to a process of dissolution, the dissolution of matter into smaller components. And there's a social analogue to that. There's a minor passage in Thucydides which refers to the conquest and scattering of the population of a Greek island. So a negative term, I think, but not a religious term. Now, we're most familiar with diaspora as it appears in the realm of Jewish history and culture. And the term itself, diaspora, comes into usage in a translation of the Hebrew Bible produced in Alexandria, known as the Septuagint, where that term is used about 12 times. To describe something. And here it gets pretty murky, and Alan, you know all about this. There are a number of keywords, of which I just want to point to three. There's Galut, there's Gola, and there's Zaba. Galut appears, as far as I can tell, to refer to the Babylonian captivity in particular. Gola refers to a geographical place, the place in which people have settled. It's not necessarily, therefore, a pejorative term. It could be a neutral or descriptive term. But diaspora is used to translate neither of them, but to translate the Hebrew term zava, which refers, or could be translated as a horror, a trouble, an object of trembling. So it's actually referring to a spiritual condition, not to Babylon or not to a geographical place. Deuteronomy 28:25 from the King James Version, the Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You will come at them from one direction but flee from them in seven, and you will become a thing of horror to all the kingdoms on the earth. That's Zaba. And that's actually what the Oxford English Dictionary quotes in support of its primary definition of diaspora. So in this sense, diaspora is a theological concept. The Jews have sinned by disregarding the law. They've been punished by being sent into exile. The possibility of redemption resides in obeying the law and in eventual return, whether it's physical or literal. And it's all too easy to see how that can be translated into a Christian idiom where the sin becomes a different and more familiar with. Diaspora in this sense involves the theory of human salvation. It's an eschatological concept, and it's a forward-looking concept. It has to do with the end of times, with the end of history. All of this, I think, is significant if you're just going to pluck the term out of the air and use it for yourself. Now, the big challenge is the extent to which that theologically specific concept could be of use across time and cultures. So you're not just going to take that term and slap it down, say, on South Asian migration in the present. You're not going to assume that the same unchanging concept can be applied over time. But no historian, I think, would expect that to have happened. We would expect a considerable change in the meaning and applicability of the concept, but sufficient continuity so that a framework of exile, connection, and return might still be useful. So part of what I'm trying to do in the book is salvage what might be useful in the concept of diaspora for our own work. If diaspora only had that specific theological meaning that I've given it, then nobody else would use it. So clearly it has a meaning beyond that. Now, what happens basically in the evolution of the term is that for the better part of two millennia, one could say that it retains a restricted meaning which has to do with Jewish history and culture. There are exceptions. Moravians, for instance, use it in a particular sense in the early modern period. But the term expands in the 20th century. First example is the Armenian case. And what's very interesting there is the retroactive impact of genocide. Because when the Holocaust takes place, the genocide that took place earlier in Armenia solidifies claims to diaspora. It's a cluster of concepts that come together, and you get an intensified reading of Armenian history. The second case, the most famous and influential, is the African case. So we can find plenty of evidence going back to the 18th and 19th century of people of African origin interpreting their historical suffering in a framework that we might call diasporic, and influenced in particular by the Old Testament and the book of Exodus. When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go, oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land, tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. That's original 19th century spiritual, sung by Paul Robeson.
I'm so glad you said that.
As well as
so much the best version.
As well as Billy Armstrong.
No, Robeson's better.
Again, I don't need to unpack the symbolism of that. Good, I got away from that one. Exodus is there, but it's not until the 1960s that the term diaspora comes into widespread usage to describe the African case, and it's now the standard term. We can talk about a little bit about why that happened. What I found in my work is that the concept of diaspora in the African case is very much a product of the Atlantic slave trade. So I don't find it in other parts of the world, even though almost as many Africans went north and east as across the Atlantic under conditions of slavery. Not only that, it's a product of the Caribbean and North America, and I don't find it among people of African origin in South America to the same extent. I don't know why, really. Diaspora doesn't seem to be as prevalent a term in Latin America generally. There are reasons to do with the intermixture of populations. I would also throw out a possible explanation, a partial explanation, which it has to do with knowledge of the Bible and Bible reading. So it could be that the African diaspora is not only an Atlantic, North Atlantic phenomenon, but a Protestant phenomenon in origin. Now, what happens next, and I'll just go on for about another 5 minutes, what happens next, remarkably, is really only since about the 1980s. You have an extraordinary proliferation of usage of the term. So we've seen it spread from the Jewish through the Armenian to the African case. A series of developments, and I'll just highlight them really as bullet points, that take place in what I'm calling the contemporary period, which is post-World War II, help explain the popularity and ubiquity of the term. They have to do with decolonization, which creates new forms of global solidarity among people of common origin. They have to do with the phenomenon of repeat migration, especially people of Asian origin who had once migrated and are then displaced from parts of Asia or Africa. The international recognition of refugees, the scale of international migration, the efforts by governments today to reach out and claim their diasporas. You see this in Armenia, Ireland, China, India. The African Union has called the African diaspora the sixth region of the African Union. Reaching out, claiming their diaspora, looking for investment, looking for political support, offering flexible citizenship in return. So there's a whole cluster of issues there. The problem, conceptually, as diaspora spreads and proliferates, is that it's drained of meaning. And so we arrive at the impasse, which scholars have been commenting on actually for quite some time now, that often the term doesn't mean very much at all. And I think part of the conceptual problem actually stems from the attempt to define, the actual attempt to impose a definition, because it's very hard at this point to pin down diaspora under a single fixed meaning. At the same time, if you leave it open-ended, there's not much. That's not much use either. So there's various attempts to define the term typologically. So to construct a typology, it's very common in sociology, political science, other disciplines, to create an elaborate typology for what diaspora is or is not. The problem with that is these quickly become fixed and static. They also can appear arbitrary. Why are your criteria better than my criteria? They are also, sometimes they involve incommensurable categories. So one is emphasizing migration, another is emphasizing the experience abroad. And I think at their worst, they become checklists. So you've got 10 criteria. If you can take off 6 boxes, you're in. If you've only 5, you're not in. That takes us only so far. An alternative approach is a discursive approach to treat diaspora as a form of discourse that helps produce meaning, patterns of culture and representation. So the question there is not what diaspora is, but what it does. And that, I think, is a very fruitful approach with one caveat. You have to have a body of discourse to examine, and that's very much a historian's take. But I can't do a discursive analysis of diasporic sensibility if nobody's articulating that sensibility for me. Otherwise, I'm just going to impose sensibility and consciousness on my subjects, which we tend to do a lot, actually, but we try not to. So some quite good articles have come out on this. One is called The Diaspora Diaspora, which explains how the concept has just gone off on its own journey.
In the Journal of Repetition.
The Journal of Repetition. And another plays on the original Greek meaning and just shows how the concept is dissolving. Okay, and then just to finish up, because I do have to write a book about this, right? This is chapter one. So what do I do in a situation like that? I can throw up my hands and say, well, nothing I can do about that, sorry, I'll cancel that contract. Or I can take a stand and say to the reader, okay, I know quite a bit about this, here's what I think might be helpful. Come along on this journey with me and see if it works, and make up your own mind. So the trick there is not to construct a rigid typology of what diaspora is or is not, and not to leave the meaning open-ended, but somehow to mediate between those two or preferably go beyond it. So what I really do is I argue in the end that diaspora is a concept, a stance on the world, a perspective on the world, that can help make sense of the world of migration. That's the argument I'm making. Now, who uses that concept? Is it people like me who analyzing migration, or is it people like me who have migrated, right? Is it both of me, or just one of me? So is it scholars, is it migrants, or is it both of me? The answer is it's both groups. That's what I'm arguing, is that scholars, journalists, writers can use this concept as a category of analysis, but it's also a category of practice. We can talk more about that. What I suggest is that if I'm trying to understand the world of migration, that there are certain situations in which diaspora can help me to do that, or can help migrants to do that. Migrations often take the form of networks. Diasporas often take the form of, conceptually, have to do with connections and networks. There's one line of inquiry there. I do find, however, that in the work I'm doing, that diaspora is still at its most useful for involuntary migrations, however we define that, but it just has a tighter or sharper analytical edge when I'm dealing with some kinds of migrations rather than others. So my diaspora is useful because it allows me to distinguish between the two in a flexible way. Regardless of the form of migration, I find that migrants abroad can engage in activities and form connections among themselves that can usefully be described as diasporic. So regardless of the form of migration. And I find that those connections become most meaningful when they are multipolar rather than unilinear. What I mean by that is in standard migration history, We examine the movement from country A to country B and the relation between them. With the world of multipolar connectivity that diaspora opens up, we'll have people of common origin, globally scattered, beginning to communicate among themselves as well as with a homeland if they have one. In that model, which is more of a web or a network, the homeland can actually be decentered and become just one part of the larger whole. The idea of return is central. It can be literal, as we see with Zionism. It can be metaphorical, as we see with many of the African cases. So in the chapter on return, I write in the same chapter about Zionism and Rastafarianism. They're both forms of return in the conceptual framework I'm using. Two corollaries from what I'm saying is that migration needs to be to several destinations at once rather than one destination for this approach to be useful to me. And communities need to endure over time in order to articulate the type of diasporic sensibility that one might analyze. Final point is that I see diaspora right now as working in two quite contrary directions, and this is very interesting. Diaspora, in a certain sense, has a powerful anti-essentialist component. In other words, it challenges the relationship between people and place. It detaches people from place. In the language of cultural studies, it's concerned with roots or routes. We say in North America, routes over roots. So it can offer a critique of nationalism, a critique of race, by conceptualizing peoplehood as transcending geographical or political boundaries. And I think we're most familiar with diaspora in that sense, and that's one of the reasons it's an attractive or trendy term. But it can also have almost the opposite effect, depending on who's using it and how. The strong tendency to homogenize when you use diaspora, to paper over difference, temporal difference, social distinction. All people from a single place of origin become a single people by virtue of that single place of origin. Diaspora is then a matter of biological destiny. You end up, ironically, with a form of national history writ large. I'll give you an example from any of the main cases I deal with in the book, Jewish, Irish, African. You cannot reduce African history to the modern slave trade. You cannot reduce Irish history to the famine, Jewish history to the Babylonian captivity. There's a very strong tendency to do that if you sort of allow yourself to be seduced by diaspora. To get away from that, I think you need a comparative dimension where you compare globally scattered communities. But in the end, if you're interested in what brings them together, diaspora is useful. Thank you.